of it, but I guess you can do whatever you like as long as Mr. Helpline is happy. But if you're looking for a feature story, why don't you visit the Medium?
Medium what?
The Medium. The psycho or psychic, whatever you call it. Parents went to her to try to figure out where their daughter was. You could use that to do a piece on her, kind of a profile. She said she saw green and yellow, but there's no yellow in that fountain, and the only green is algae, which wouldn't have been there the night she disappeared. And the bartender had already told police she was wearing a green blouse, so that wasn't new. I bet if you ask her today to explain that, she'll say the face was turned toward the sun, only it wasn't. Or that there were daffodils along the lake, but there weren't, not in January. He laughed, and his laugh took over until he could barely speak. He had amused himself. Don't call first, because, literally slapping his own knee now, because I bet she'll never see you coming. The cop reporter. I know what my coworkers say behind my back. They call me Deputy Dog. They say I've gone native, that I'm more cop than reporter, that I can't write my way out of a paper bag, which is why I'm still on the cop beat after 30 years. No one serious about his newspaper career stays on the cop beat. Look at this little filly, thinking she's gonna make a career writing about some dead Negro. She doesn't get it. Even at the Star, which doesn't try to be like the fancy pants Beacon, with its foreign bureaus and eight-man staff in D.C., the cop beat is supposed to be a way station, a place you pass through. A 52-year-old cop reporter is unusual. To my face, the other cop reporters call me the Dean. They pretend to look up to me. They try to steal my sources, certain they can do better by them. But I have these sources because I'm not going anywhere. These young guys would betray someone in a flash. I socialize with the men on my beat. I go to their kids' christenings, attend the occasional FOP bull roast, buy rounds at the bar the cops favor. I'm happy at HQ. My stomach drops to my ankles when I have to show up at the newsroom, unless it's to pick up my paycheck or cash out my expenses. Those are the only good reasons to walk into the Star. My father was a newspaper man in Philadelphia, a columnist, a legend. Johnny Diller. He was Jonathan. I'm John. A mistake on the birth certificate that stuck, so I'm no junior and I don't let anyone call me Johnny. Of course I wanted to do what my old man did. It looked fun. People acted as if he was special because his name was on the front page of the paper on a regular basis. I ended up at the Star because I went to Hopkins, edited the newsletter. I always imagined I'd make the 100-mile journey back home someday, maybe as a columnist or a political writer. There was only one problem. I couldn't write. I mean, yes, I can put sentences together in the right order, but I lost any flair I once had. I don't know how to explain it. The way they structure things at newspapers is that you don't write at first. You go to a crime scene, you find a payphone, you call the facts in to rewrite. In an afternoon paper, there's no time to get back to the office and file. You know where every payphone in the city is, phone booths on your desk. When I caught my first murder, my third day of work, I laboriously wrote the story in my notebook, thinking I would dictate it to the rewrite guy, saving him the work. He chewed me out. I wasn't saving him time. I was wasting time because what I had written was no good. This is what I need, and this is the order I need it in, he barked at me. And when I would try to add a bit of color or a detail I found interesting, he would say, "Answer only the questions I ask, son." I thought to myself, I'll show them. I began working on a novel at night. I poured everything I had into a story about a boy growing up in Philadelphia, one who lived on the right side of the tracks but was drawn to the wrong side, befriended a boy there. Classic stuff, dead-end kids. One grows up to be a priest, the other a criminal, only not quite as stark as that. In my book, one boy was going to grow up to be a reporter, the other one was going to be a cop, and they would end up at cross purposes. The reporter insisting on printing something that undercut a major murder case gave the killer a chance to go free. The cop does what he feels he has to do, kills the killer, and he's arrested. I thought I was hot stuff. One night, I was sitting at my typewriter looking at what I had written so far. By writing 2 pages a day, I had amassed 300 pages midway into the year, almost a full novel. I began reading back through what I had accomplished, and I was struck by 2 things. One, I really hated the reporter in my own story. All my sympathies were with the cop, although the reporter was the autobiographical character. 2, I couldn't write. I couldn't write for sour apples. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't bad. It just wasn't good. I swear I was good once. I had filled notebooks with poetry and short stories, won contests in high school and college, but the star, that rewrite man, had destroyed something in me and I couldn't get it back. I felt like a god stripped of his powers, forced to wander the earth in his reduced state as punishment. Only punishment for what? As long as I kept calling my stories in to rewrite, my writing skills were going to diminish. The star's narrow-minded view of what made a story was destroying my own. But what if I moved up, got a new beat, and I still couldn't write? What then? At that moment, I can still see myself at the desk in the living room. My young, then, wife gone to bed long ago, my shirt sleeves rolled up, and it's like seeing a man who thinks he can fly, only to wake from a dream and find himself standing on a ledge. I froze. I don't think I could have pressed a key on my typewriter with a gun to my head. I developed writer's block. I have it to this day. I can't write sentences, only words. I jot down facts in my notebook, but that doesn't count as writing, that's stenography. I actually know steno, which is why my notes are so good, so reliable, my quotes never questioned. No one has ever accused me of getting so much as a word wrong. When all the papers cover the same story and there's a discrepancy in a quote or a fact, I'm the one who got it right. I haven't had a single correction in almost 30 years on the job. Do you know how unusual that is? At lunch, I ask the lady, Maddie Marjorie, to cover her half. She seems a little surprised, but she gives me her share, as she should. This isn't a date. I pocket the check and go back to the office, fill out my expenses, including the one for the lunch I just had, writing Sergeant Patrick Mahoney on the back of the slip, and walk away with a nice fistful of cash. After work, I head to the cop's favorite bar, where I use my expense money to buy everyone around, then grab the check so I can submit that expense later. All legitimate. If buying a cop a beer isn't part of doing my job, I don't know what is. I see the patrolman from the Tessie Fine case, the one who was first on the scene, a young Polack with a reputation for being too good for his own good. He never stays for more than one beer, and he has a sanctimonious puss on him. Talks a little too much about his wife and not in the way most of the guys do, with good-natured jokes and complaints. No, this guy's wife is a saint, an angel. The man doth protest too much, if you ask me. Did you know that that nice lady The one who found Tessie Fine's body and became the killer's pen pal, is working at the paper now? See, I give a little, then maybe I get a little. He frowns. Well, I'm not sure she's a nice lady. What makes you say that? I don't want to gossip. Which is, of course, the first thing someone says right before he gossips. This one in particular likes to gossip, although he doesn't call it that. Men never do. I prime the pump. She's decided she wants to look into the Cleo Sherwood case. The barmaid from the Flamingo, the round heels. Who cares about that? Nobody cares, so why not let her have a crack at it? She sure does like 'em dark, he says. I lean in, slide my pack of cigarettes across the bar to him. I know him. He won't stay for another beer, but he might nurse the one beer through a smoke. Not sure I catch your drift. You ever meet a patrol named Ferdy Platt? Northwest, blacker than ink? She knows him. He leans hard on that word, knows. Make sure I understand the implications. Yeah? I've been looking into him. He's cozy with Shell Gordon, who owns the Flamingo. I don't think she's trying to get a story out of Cleo Sherwood. I think she's fishing to take information back to Platt. I think he told her some stuff about the Tessie Fine case, which is how Bob Bauer knew what he knew. If she's chasing this story, even money, that Ferdy Platt put her up to it. Why would he do that? He exhales smoke from his cigarette. Got me. But I saw him coming and going from her place, which sure as hell isn't in the Northwest, I know that much. And what were you doing there? The Polack pulls on his beer, doesn't comment. That's the thing about this guy. He's got the soul of a rat. He's a tattletale who's never grown up. He's always keeping score. I have to go, he says. My wife doesn't sleep soundly until I get home. He leaves me to puzzle over what he's told me. So this little housewife got her big break because she has a cop boyfriend. A colored one, at that. I wonder if he put her up to writing those letters to Tessie Fine's killer. Told her what to say. If the homicide cops were working her through him. But the cops I know were genuinely upset when the story broke, when the Star pointed out the discrepancy between what Corwin told them and what he told her. The thing about the car, the accomplice. 3 months later, he's still holding firm with them, insisting it was all a lie, that he just made stuff up to mess with her. But obviously there's an accomplice out there, and it's driving them nuts. If they had the accomplice, they could play the two against each other, cinch a death penalty case for one of them. But I'm no tattletale. I won't go running back to the paper and tell folks that this new girl is sleeping with a cop. It's not like she's going to end up covering cops. Not for the Star. What did you think when you saw the body? Did I become more real to you? Or less? It was a monstrous thing, I bet, like something from a horror movie. The creature from the Park Lagoon. I can't bear to call it mine. Can anyone? You, the morgue people, the detectives, still see a person in that thing. I don't blame people for not caring. I don't care. I can't feel anything for that mound of flesh and bone, holding stubbornly to its secrets. Full credit to you for staring it down at all. I know it sounds silly, but I was naked, I assume. What happened to my clothes? Obviously, they would be the worse for wear, too, and they couldn't leave them on my body, but are they evidence? Were they examined, then stored somewhere? Cleaned up and thrown away? Every piece told a story, if anyone cared to know it. There was a world of stories in the clothing I picked out that evening. Because the weather was mild, I chose leopard print slacks, a lightweight red car coat, and an emerald green blouse beneath it, 100% silk. The combination bothered me because it was too Christmassy. But there was a man waiting for me, telling me not to dawdle. Time was a-wastin'. A scarf tied snug over the hair, straightened just the day before, no jewelry. The clothes were all gifts from my man, but that doesn't tell you the whole story. Any man can buy a woman a dress, a coat, a scarf. My man was much more cunning. He had to bide his time, then pounce on opportunities that presented themselves, just like he had pounced on me the second he saw me. Occasionally, alterations were required. He did them himself. He knew my body that well. The idea of him bent over a sewing machine, tailoring those clothes to my frame. Let's just say that when I think of that, I know he loved me, and I loved him for loving me. He was a king, and I could have been his queen. A better one than the one that was forced on him, the one everyone said he had to keep if he wanted to expand his kingdom. I had read a lot of books about Henry VIII and his wives. Anne Boleyn was my favorite. I was, in a sense, trying to play her game. Although the rules were a little different in 1965 than they were in 1500-whatever. And the game was so much bigger than I knew, bigger than me, bigger than him, bigger than all of us. June 1966. A woman in a pink housecoat opened the door when Maddie rang the bell at the psychic's. Madame Claire has a cold, Maddie thought, proud of herself for the literary illusion. Then annoyed that she could no longer remember the name of the psychic in the wasteland. The woman in the pink housecoat had a husky, almost froggy voice, but she did not appear to have so much as a sniffle. Even if she did, it was more likely to be allergies and a head cold on this balmy June day. Maddie had waited until after work to take the bus to Madame Claire's studio, an apartment carved out of the ground floor of a grand old house in Reservoir Hill. Much to her surprise and shame, she had been scolded for the 2-hour trip to the morgue, although her work had been done, and she had those 4.5 hours of comp time. There was a difference, Maddie was realizing, between being told that she had permission to work on a story and actually working on it. She owed the newspaper 8 hours every day. She was good at what she did, efficient and smart. She could do 8 hours of work in 6. But the time she saved was not hers. Like the miner in the song 16 Tons, she owed, if not her soul, her time to the company store. When she was a housewife, her speed and her efficiency had accrued to her. She had been her own boss, although she let Milton think certain decisions were his. It was odd being made to answer to men who were not her husband. It made her feel sullen and rebellious, not unlike Seth. I did my work, she wanted to say. Whose business is it if I take a long lunch to look into the Cleo Sherwood case? She knew better than to argue, however. And now she had ridden a bus to a part of the city she wouldn't have dared to drive through not that long ago. If she took a taxi home, would she be allowed to expense the fare? She doubted it. Besides, there were no taxis here. At least the days were getting longer, and it would probably still be light when she left Madame Claire, whose apartment happened to be within walking distance of Milton's synagogue. It wouldn't be there long. Chizikamuno had announced that the temple would be leaving the neighborhood for the suburbs in the coming year. After all, that was where their congregants lived, where the Jews are.
In her head, on the bus, Maddie had made that into a song to the tune of Where the Boys Are, Where the Jews Are, No One Waits for Me. Not even a year ago, she had avoided downtown Baltimore, venturing there only for the occasional symphony performance or dinner at Tio Pepe's or the Prime Rib. She had thought it dirty and dangerous. She wasn't wrong. Yet working at the Star, with its proximity to the raucous bars along the harbor, being able to walk to the grand department stores on Howard Street, she felt herself falling in love. Not with the city so much as the possibility of a new start, at an age when she had thought her life would basically be over. As a child, she used to do the math. Born in 1928, she would be 22 at mid-century, 72 at the dawn of the 21st. She had assumed she would not change, that adulthood was static. Her younger self was not wrong. Maddie's life had been set by the time she was 25. The house they bought that year, their second in Pikesville, might as well have been a mausoleum, an elegant, well-appointed mausoleum, but still a mausoleum. Seth was the only true living thing in that house, and he was about to leave. She imagined his departure like a fairy tale, or an episode of The Twilight Zone, a program she didn't really care for, but a favorite of Milton's, so they watched it all the time. The landscape of their lives would be sere, dead. The emptiness would be revealed. Did Madame Claire... Oh, Claire for clairvoyant, too clever by half. Intuit any of this as Maddie stood on her doorstep. Maddie didn't believe in psychic powers, but something in the woman's fearsome gaze suggested she could read Maddie's mind if she so desired.
Do you have an appointment?
I assumed you would know I was coming, Maddie said, and immediately regretted it. Why would she use Diller's joke? It wasn't going to endear her to the woman.
My gift is not always on, Madame Claire said. It affords me respite as needed. It can be exhausting, my gift.
A significant pause.
When I use it, I expect to be paid.
Maddie thought about her purse, the few bills she had with her, her wan hope of taking a taxi home. I'm not here as a client, I'm from the Star. I want to ask you a few questions about the reading you did when Cleo Sherwood was missing.
Questions inevitably engage the gift.
Would $3 be enough?
Let me see the bills.
She took them from Maddie and literally sniffed them. They must have been found acceptable because she took Maddie into what had once been the house's front parlor. The windows facing the street were draped with shiny red material that hoped to pass for satin, but Maddie could tell that it was a cheap imitation. There was a crystal ball, a deck of regular playing cards. Madame Claire ignored those, asking Maddie to sit opposite her and place her hands, palms up, on the table. She then put her own palms on top, her fingers reaching to Maddie's wrists. She could have taken Maddie's racing pulse if she desired, but she didn't. She didn't do anything.
So Cleo Sherwood's parents came to you? Maddie asked, breaking the uneasy silence.
The mother, not the father. The father believes what I do is the work of the devil.
Frowning.
He is a very ignorant man.
What did you see?
I held an object that her mother believed had great meaning to Cleo.
An object? This was new.
An ermine stole.
Her voice caressed the word, drew it out.
A very fine piece of clothing.
How did Cleo come to have a fur? The psychic's look was disdainful. Of course, how did any young, single woman come to have a fur? I know what you told the afro. It doesn't seem to have been... Maddie had to tread carefully. It didn't match up with where she was found. Maybe the green because of the park or her blouse, but not the yellow. Was it from earlier in the evening, this color yellow that you saw? Madame Claire nodded.
Yes. I was seeing something from earlier. I think she must have been in a yellow room. Yellow was the last thing she saw.
You mean she was killed elsewhere? Maddie thought back to the morgue, the medical examiner's scenarios. A dead body is heavy. It would be impossible for a man, even a strong one, to heave it up and into the fountain.
Yellow is the last thing she saw,
Madame Claire repeated. Maddie could not believe she had squandered time and money for so little. The detail about the stole was new, but it wasn't enough to make an article. Do you see anything else? She closed her eyes and kept them closed for so long that Maddie began to wonder if she'd fallen asleep. Then her eyes flew open with what was clearly practiced flair.
A secret.
Cleo Sherwood had a secret.
No. I think it's yours.
Maddie had to will herself not to snatch her hands back from Madame Claire's rough ones. Everyone has secrets, she said.
Yes, they do. But you have one that's been causing you distress. It's like a tiny pebble in your shoe, yet you keep walking. All you have to do is stop, shake it out, and you'll feel better, but you don't want to. I wonder why that is. It's not a big secret, yet you don't want anyone to know.
Did Madame Claire mean Ferdy, who had just flashed through her mind? Don't be silly, she scolded herself. The woman is a fraud. This is all hokum. Maybe it's not my secret to tell, or not mine alone.
No, this happened long ago. But I also see yellow in your aura, although it's slipping away, disappearing, as if the lights are going out very slowly. Is it a street light? I don't know, it's gone now.
Maddie put her hands in her lap, breaking the connection just in case. Do you ever feel guilty about what you do?
Why would I feel guilty?
Your reading for Cleo Sherwood's mother gave her hope. But she was almost certainly dead by the time she consulted you. You couldn't give her any real answers.
I did not ask for the gift, and I don't make people come to me. I did not make you come to me. And I don't promise answers. People ask me what I see and I tell them. It's not my fault that the other world is indirect, that the visions don't come with explanations.
Can you tell me anything about my future? So far you seem to be looking only at my past. Madame Claire took a deep breath and held it, staring into Maddie's eyes, her pupils dilating. Maddie felt like a cobra facing a snake charmer. Finally, Madame Claire exhaled.
Danger, she said. I see danger.
I'm in danger. Her voice was shrill, the walk home on her mind.
No, you are danger. You're gonna hurt someone terribly, cause all kinds of trouble.
Oh, she thought. Disappointed in spite of herself. That was the past again. Milton. She had hurt him. Seth, too. Sometimes she wondered if she should have told Milton everything. If exposing her fraud at this late date would make him feel better about her leaving. Still. Yellow, disappearing. The eclipse, that damn eclipse. She walked home in the June twilight, feeling like a character in Greek mythology, perhaps Orpheus, going into hell to retrieve Eurydice. She held her spine straight, carried her pocketbook with the strap across her chest as women were cautioned to do now. She tried not to walk too quickly, in part because her heels were not made for a fast pace, but also because she wanted to appear as if she feared nothing. but she was such an obvious outsider that the men she passed seemed to fall back, allow her extra room. Did they see danger, too? That night, she left her window open, a risky thing to do. But the late spring air was fresh and sweet, perhaps because of the gardens at the cathedral. There were so few natural scents in this part of Baltimore. It was as if the seasons bypassed downtown altogether. She slid into bed, not a stitch on. About 2 a.m., she heard soft footsteps on the fire escape, listened as the window was pushed wider open. A man's body covered her, possessed her.
"We've talked about this, Maddie," Ferdy said afterward. "Don't leave that window open. Someone other than me could get in."
"Maybe I left it open for someone else." A pause. The room was dark. She could not see his expression.
"Don't be like that."
"Like what?"
"Like, well, some stripper or some lady who goes with anybody."
"Like Cleo Sherwood."
"You still talking about that?"
"I'm going to write about her. A woman is dead. Maybe I can make people see that they should care about that." He sighed.
"I doubt it."
"Did you know her?"
"Hell no. The Flamingo Club wasn't part of my beat."
"Do you think she had a boyfriend? A secret one?"
"More than one, no doubt."
He smacked her rump, but lightly. His sign for her to roll over and get on all fours. She had told him once that she had never had sex in anything but the missionary position, that Milton wouldn't hear of it. That had been true, but also a lie. She and Milton had done it only one way, but Milton was not, despite what he still believed, her only lover. And her first lover had been a bold man who could, alas, convince her to do almost anything. A green silk sofa, the yellow sliver of a moon during an eclipse. Ah, but that was Madame Claire's trick, right? Whatever color she saw, the client filled in the story. The medium.
It is hard for people who don't have the gift to understand it. Yet, maybe necessary, too. If you knew what I see, how I see, well. There was a time when they burned women like me. And maybe that was a kindness. I can tell that the woman who has come to see me today is not a believer. So I decide to throw a little scare into her. She isn't worthy of my gift. She doesn't want to use it for good. I tell her she has a secret. Because who doesn't? I did see the aura of yellow around her, though almost in spite of myself. What I couldn't tell was whether it was connected to her or something that has hung in the air since Cleo Sherwood's mother visited me, asked me to stroke that piece of fur. At the time, I was so sure the girl was still alive. And maybe she was, who knows? Her body could have gone into the lake in late February. But if she was still alive, where was she? Why couldn't I save her? Was the green the color of the walls in a room where she was kept? Was the yellow I saw a lone bulb in someone's basement prison? I was 8 when I first realized I had second sight. I had a dream. In it, my aunt, who was only a teenager, was riding in a car with a man, someone she barely knew. He was driving too fast. She begged him to slow down. The car went out of control. My aunt was injured. The man died. I woke up that morning and those very things had happened. My aunt was in the hospital with a broken leg. The man driving the car was dead. I told my mama that I had dreamed this thing. At first, she tried to talk me out of it. She said, "No, honey, you must have heard us talking in the night. Or maybe you had the dream the next night, but it's jumbled in your head. The order of things, because things were so crazy that day after it happened. So many people coming and going, and we were so worried she was going to die." I believe now that Mama feared for me. She knew the gift would exact a price. And it has. I cannot control it. I cannot summon it. People would think I was a fake if I admitted this part. So I don't mention that. The thing is, anyone who comes to see me gets good advice. They get their money's worth. But not everyone has a true psychic experience. That's not in my control. Cleo Sherwood's mother, she got the real thing. There was green and yellow all around. I thought it might be the sun. I thought she was someplace where she couldn't turn her head and was forced to look into the sun. Maybe it was a room or a ceiling, but her last living, waking minutes were surrounded by yellow. I am confident in that. After the lady leaves, I don't need my powers to realize she felt dissatisfied. I turn off my light and decide to close up for the day, although I usually do more business in the evenings. Most people, especially churchy ones, prefer to visit me when it's dark. But I am drained. Even the smallest vibration takes a lot out of me. I am 47 years old. I've been married 3 times, each time a disaster. But I never talk about it because, again, people would doubt my abilities. How does a psychic pick such bad husbands? By listening to her heart. The heart knows nothing, sees nothing, but it kicks up a ruckus, throws tantrums to get what it wants. No one understands this thing I do, who I am, how my power works. It's not a machine that can be plugged in and turned on. The gift is sensitive. It prefers dry weather to wet, cold, to hot. Cleo's mother came to me on a good day, cold and bright and dry. When the air has that thin, hard edge, I can feel things I can't on other days. I could see inside Mrs. Sherwood's soul, and it was the saddest thing I have ever glimpsed. She loved that girl of hers. She wanted me to see something that would suggest she was alive. Maybe that was why I thought it possible. I don't think she loves her husband or her other children as much as she loves this girl, the one who's been so much trouble to her. Some mothers are like that. As I stroked that stole, it almost seemed to come to life like a cat getting its back scratched. And a scent rose from it, sweet and stale, some kind of perfume. It smelled like yearning. She had wanted something awfully bad, that girl. I saw yellow, bright, blinding yellow. I saw a woman whose face was turned to the sun, maybe flew too close to it, as that old story goes. We are not meant to fly. We're not meant to see the things I see. I'm a good woman, a church-going woman, and there are Sundays when I would never tell my preacher this. I pray to God to let me see less. But God says, Suzanne, my real name is Suzanne, I don't give the gift to people who can't handle it. That woman, the one who came asking questions about Cleo Sherwood, she was up to no good. I could smell the yearning on her, too, but there was no sweetness to it. She was like a car engine, revving, 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 making noise, sending sparks out into the world. She wants to get somewhere. Trouble is, she doesn't know where she wants to go. That's what makes her dangerous. I enjoy my supper, a pork chop and string beans, let myself have a little sweet wine, which calms me down. I get ready for bed, for sleep, which I dread. My dreams are a burden because they sometimes come true. But I don't know which ones will come true and which ones won't. Have you ever had the sensation of being stuck in an awful dream and then you wake up, experience relief because it's not happening? I am denied that release until I can check to make sure that my dreams have not come true. Yes, my vision is a gift, but it's not one I asked for, and I long to return it. Take this from me, God, it's not right
Make me ordinary. A woman who can live with a man, put her head on the pillow at night without fearing what might visit her in her dreams. What might still be waiting for her after daybreak, when the dreams and nightmares end for everyone else.
Green and yellow, huh? You get what you pay for, Maddie Schwartz. You know what was green and yellow? The upholstery on the balcony seats in the theater where I sat 2 weeks before I died. My man had surprised me by taking me to New York, where he had tickets to a musical, Man of La Mancha. They weren't very good seats, and we were the only Negroes in the audience, best I could tell. And the music? Well, to me it was kind of trifling, old people stuff, but it moved him, I could tell. I watched tears slide down his cheeks, only not during the song that everyone knows, the one that's on the radio. Again, that's only if you listen to old people radio. He out and out sobbed at the end, when the woman said the dead man in the bed was not the man she knew, that the man she knew and loved still lived somewhere. I thought in that moment that he would be mine, that he would choose to be the hero, not the man in the bed. But no, he was crying because he knew his limitations, knew what he would choose in the end. He was weak. I watched him watching the show about the show inside the show. It reminded me of that infinity joke we tell each other as kids. I'm painting a picture of myself, painting a picture of myself, painting a picture. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller until you can't see anything. So I decided for myself, I'll be the one who lives. Not the old man in the bed up on stage. Not the wild, beautiful wives of Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, and Catherine Howard. And not the last one, the nurse, that no one really talks about, who died pretty soon after he did. I'd be Mary Boleyn, Anne's sister, who fooled them all and had a good long life. That's what I would choose. It was too late. The choice to live had been taken from me, and I didn't even know it. At 3 a.m. on January 1st, I went to my closet and picked clothes for my date, taking time to make sure that none of Letitia's clothes were mixed up with mine. We borrowed one another's clothes, but mine were so much nicer. It wasn't the first time I'd made a late date, and I was always alone on holidays, that's how it works. The second shift is how I thought of it. My man was generous, but I always needed more. And I didn't make the tips I deserved stuck behind the bar, and whose fault was that? Everybody knew I had late dates. Except him. I hope he never knew. But I'm sure that those who wanted to turn him against me saw to it that he found out. I pushed that fur far back in my closet, making sure it was in a dry cleaning bag, as if winter were over. It was for me. Everything was over for me. Mine wasn't the nicest neighborhood. My apartment wasn't that great, even with the view of the park and the lake. I suppose the buildings along Druid Hill were grand once when white people lived in them, but it had been a while. That was the story of the neighborhood, the story of the world. White people always get out just in time. They have an instinct for when the plumbing's going to go, when the wiring will fray and crackle. Look at you, Madeline Schwartz, leaping from your marriage when you did. You probably thought you were getting out in the nick of time. I pushed my fur into the back of the closet and went out on my date, dread bubbling up in my stomach. But I had to go. The ending had been written. It was out of my hands. 6 weeks later, when my mama convinced the landlord to open the door for her, she found my fur and recognized it was something I loved. She carried it to the psychic, who buried her face in its pale pink silk lining, stroked the white pelt. It was rabbit, but she pronounced it ermine, which tells you everything you need to know about the woman who claimed she saw my final hours. Green and yellow indeed. Sure, I wore a green blouse, but the real green was jealousy. And there was no yellow.
unless you count the cowardice of the man who decreed I had to die, but would not deign to do the job himself. June, 1966.
You did what?
Judith Weinstein had been about to sip a spoonful of chicken soup with Kreplach when Maddie told her about the visit to Madame Claire. As fastidious in her manners as she was in her appearance, Judith could arrest her spoon's arc without spilling a drop. But she was gratifyingly amazed by Maddie's recent adventures. I went to the morgue to see Cleo Sherwood's body. Then I visited the psychic that her mother consulted. That dead Negro girl, the one who worked in Shell Gordon's club. She worked at the Flamingo, is that the place you mean? Who's Shell Gordon? Judith snorted, although it was more like a cat's sneeze, tidy and contained. I told you, Maddie, Stuart Peanut Shell Gordon. He's a small-timer trying to be a big-timer like Willie Adams, whom he idolizes and loathes in equal measure. I've never heard of any of these people. I told you, you should come to the Stonewall Club with me. It's interesting. Although I know most of this stuff from my Uncle Donald. Shell Gordon wants to be a power broker, like Adams. He puts out a lot of walk-around money on election day. Walk-around money? Judith sipped her soup. A strange choice for such a warm day. The suburban house's soups were good, but Maddie was treating herself to a full feast, a bagel with lox and cream cheese, accompanied by a tab. She had walked so much this week. Besides, Ferdy liked her as she was. It's how you get your vote out. But it's illegal to pay people to vote. Judith smiled, happy for the chance to be the wise one in their new tender friendship. You don't pay people to vote, exactly. You pay people to get out the vote. I'm not sure I see the distinction. In the end, there might not be one. Maddie wasn't interested in a political tutorial. She had sought Judith out because she needed a confidant, someone to listen to her stories from work. Ferdy, she assumed, would be either bored or scandalized by her adventures, going to the morgue, venturing into a Negro neighborhood. Certainly she could never tell her mother what she was up to. So she had looked for a friend, and realized she had none. She had tried calling Eleanor Rosengren, whom she had not seen since that fateful dinner. Really, that was not hyperbole. The dinner had changed her life, with Wallace Wright. But Eleanor had seemed distant, odd. Lines had been drawn up in Pikesville, and Maddie realized that her old friends would be on Milton's side, as surely as they lived on the county side of the city-county line. Maddie had abandoned not only Milton, but the whole neighborhood. Her new way of life was a rebuke to all of them. So she returned to Judith, the eager young woman who always jumped when she called. And it was gratifying how happy she was to make this dinner date. She had even suggested that they go to a movie at the Pikes Theater later, volunteering to drive Maddie home in her father's car. Maddie had assumed their dinner conversation would be about her work exploits, that Judith had no stories to share. To her surprise, and truthfully, to her annoyance, Judith had a confidence, too. Remember those cops from the day when it was hard still to talk about Tessie Fine, the silvery sole of that shoe, the red hair, the green coat? Of course, mine called me. Maddie took a note of the word, mine. Had the other cop been hers? He had wanted to walk her to her door, but surely that was just politeness. At any rate, he had not called her or followed up in any way, and she felt a tiny shock of jealousy, as if she and Judith were two girls who had gone on a double date. But Judith's date had been successful and hers was not. Silly, she would never date a cop. Oh. She was dating a cop. No, not dating. That was not the word for what she and Ferdy did. She blushed. Not that Judith seemed to notice. What did he want? Judith took no offense at the question. Borderline rude as it was, he asked me to go out. I knew my mother would be scandalized, but it was my father who really hit the roof. I don't know if it was the cop part or the Irish part. At any rate, he said there was no way any daughter of his would go out with such a man. A shame, Maddie said, not meaning it. He was cute. Again, not meaning it, she couldn't recall anything about the man but his vapid chatter. He wants to meet up with us tonight, Judith said. At the theater. If that's okay. Maddie felt silly. A little used, although she was the one who had called Judith. She even felt her allegiances shifting toward Judith's parents, to whom she might have been closer in age. If Seth had wanted to date a Shiksa, a cop's daughter, Maddie would not have approved. But she also would have been careful not to object. That's how her mother had handled her high school relationship with Alan, pretending not to be worried, inviting his parents over for Passover dinner. How, Maddie wondered, would her mother have acted if she had known about Maddie's true first love? Somehow she had managed to hide him from everyone. Perhaps that was her real talent, secret loves. But it was 1966, being a courtesan was not a career. Courtesan. She could hear her first love laughing at her across the years. Euphemisms are for cowards, Maddie. He had laughed at her a lot, come to think of it. Mocked her ambition to write. Said she would be just another suburban mama. Of course that's okay, she assured Judith. And I thought, Judith said, if you don't mind, we'd give you cab fare to get home. You see, if my parents think that I have to drive you back to the city and home again, that's a good hour of time, and her turn to blush. Maddie would have been quite jealous now, except that she knew whatever Judith and her date did in their stolen hour could not compare to what she and Ferdy accomplished in that same window of time. But oh, how lovely it would be to sit in a movie theater, holding hands with someone, anyone. Was this always the choice? Passion or respectability? The movie was The Sandpiper. After a carefully staged chance encounter in the lobby, the trio chose seats toward the rear of the theater. Then Maddie insisted on moving closer to the front, claiming she had forgotten her glasses. She didn't wear glasses. Judith and her cop, Paul something, made faint protests. He was in civilian clothes. He was not especially attractive, not to Maddie, but there was something about the knowledge of this forbidden love, lust, 11 rows back that aroused her. Or maybe it was Richard Burton, so attractive despite his pocked skin. She found herself quite stirred up. And then she realized that the man next to her had put his hand on her knee. She picked it up and put it back in his lap, stealing a glance at him. He did not appear depraved. He was not trying to touch himself, and his eyes were fixed on the film. She should have been screaming for an usher, and yet his profile was quite nice. A fine Roman nose, a thick head of hair, long-lashed eyes behind his glasses. There was no dirty raincoat, no unzipped trousers. It was then that Maddie screamed. Not because she was scared, not really. Oh, she was terrified, but not by this man. She was horrified by her lack of fear. Overwhelmed by the thought, however fleeting, that she could lead this man out of the theater and do things to him. Let him do things to her. She was becoming depraved. There was no other word for it. This was why she had married as quickly as possible. Because her first love had awakened this terrible lust in her, and she knew she had to bottle it, tame it. Now it was out again, loose in the world. Of course, once she started shouting, Paul and Judith came to her rescue as well, while the man with the Roman nose was never seen again. There was no talk of cab fare, given the fright Maddie had endured. The two drove her home. Maddie almost felt guilty for depriving them of their time together. Then again, they had left the film 45 minutes in, so they still had at least an hour to spend in each other's company. Judith reported in the next day. whispering on the line from her brother's jewelry store. He wanted to park on Silburn Avenue, she said, near... Is that weird? No, Maddie said. Yes, she thought, but not as weird as what I wanted to do last night, so who am I to judge? A libertine, she thought after hanging up. I am becoming a libertine. Where had she first heard that word? From her first lover, of course. Was he still alive? He had moved away long ago, and she had lost track of him. But given the family's Baltimore connections, she assumed there would be an obituary in the local papers if he died. There would definitely be an obituary if his wife died. But he was not old yet, only going on 60. There was no reason to think he had passed. She saw herself, not quite 18, standing on the sidewalk and watching movers carry furniture into a van. Where are they going? She asked the least intimidating of the men. New York, he grunted. I know him. Them, she offered. I went to school with their son. The moving man was not interested. For months, the gravest fear of Maddie's life had been that someone would discover her secret, what she had done. But now she saw the worst fate was no one's knowing. She had kept their secret too well. All the promises, the whispered words, the vows made in exchange for taking from her something she could never reclaim. There were no witnesses. Only he knew how he had spoken of their running away together, of the visions he had painted, better with words than he ever was with a brush, of a future in which they lived in the village, true libertines, caring about nothing but art and love. She could not prove it had happened, any of it. The most significant event of her young life was being hauled onto that truck, transported to New York, of all places, but probably not the village, never the village. They probably were going to live on the Upper East Side, in the kind of house and household that he said he despised. The movers carried a green silk sofa into the van. Maddie had lost her virginity on that sofa the summer she was 17. Can't you stay a little later? He had asked. There's going to be an eclipse tonight. That's practically a once-in-a-lifetime event. And I know your parents never worry when you're here with me. No, they never did, even at 17. Maddie understood how ironic this was. 2 months later, in the fall, she met Milton. Of course, he had assumed she was a virgin, and she saw no reason to contradict him. She was, and she wasn't. She was someone new, a different Maddie. If anything, she felt more innocent, younger for having been defiled and tricked by an older man, who had no compunction about using words to talk her out of what people claimed was her greatest gift, her singular asset to offer a man, the only dowry that still mattered. Did Cleo Sherwood have a boyfriend? Everyone said no, but casual dates didn't give a girl an ermine stole. Cherchez l'homme. Maddie was going to find Cleo's lover, this married man. Demand answers. It would make up for her lack of nerve when she was 17 and she failed again and again in her resolve to introduce herself to her lover's wife. Of course, his wife already knew her, but only as her son's classmate, the girl he had dated, asked to the prom, then dumped. The girl whose portrait her husband was painting in his studio. The resulting painting was stiff, absent of her vitality and charm, absent of all the qualities he said he saw in her. When he put his brushes down and made love to her again and again and again, the summer she was 17. The moviegoer. I swear I have never done anything like that in my life. It was not a plan. Okay, yes, it was a plan to sit next to her. I have my choice of seats, after all. The theater isn't crowded, and I usually don't like to be that close to the screen. It hurts my neck, my eyes. But I see her go in with the couple, almost like their chaperone, then leave them to the back row as she moves down front. I follow, sitting across the aisle, then moving next to her after the cartoon, just as the feature begins. I don't want to tell you what I do. I'm respectable, trust me on that. I'm a good man, a good provider. Yes, I am married, but my wife is cold to me. She has always been cold to me. I don't think she likes me. I ask her sometimes, do you like me? And she says, I love you. As if that's better, as if that should be enough. But it's not. I need her to like me, too, to laugh at my jokes, to seem less put upon by my general existence. When I come home at the end of the day, my wife seems to find my very presence in the house an imposition. A nice house that I pay for. It reminds me of the old myth, Cupid and Psyche. Only she can't be bothered to try to steal a look at me as I sleep. She'd be fine being married to the monster as long as he brought home a paycheck. So, sometimes, I tell her I have to work late and I go to the movies or stop in somewhere for a drink. But you have to believe me, I have never, ever done anything like what I do tonight. And what I do, is it really that big a deal? I touch a leg, a knee, outside.